May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Joseph Adams, and I represent the plaintiff, James Mills. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
The District Court erred in granting defendants' motion to dismiss and motion for judgment on the pleadings, and both orders should be reversed. The order granting the motion to dismiss erroneously applies the statute of limitations. This case involves two separate distinct tolling periods. The first period ran from the date of Mr. Mills' arrest to the date of his sentencing. The second period ran from the date of his conviction to the date that conviction was reversed on appeal.
Can I ask a question? This is interesting to me that both parties appear to assume that the date of accrual was the date of the arrest. But that's a legal question that we have to decide for ourselves. Is that conclusion driven by Wallace? Does Wallace hold as a legal matter that the date of accrual was the date of the arrest, or is there a possibility that it could have been later?
Correct. No, that is governed by Wallace, and Wallace dealt with a situation that had occurred after the Heck decision, where a number of courts were interpreting Heck as essentially a deferred accrual rule.
Including this court in the Harvey case, right?
That's correct, yes. And in Wallace, the court clarified that that's not the case. And accrual with respect to the Fourth Amendment claims, not with respect to the malicious prosecution claim, but the Fourth Amendment claims accrued on the date of the arrest. We certainly concede that issue, and we do believe that's governed by Wallace.
So basically, no tolling from arrest to conviction?
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor. Under California Government Code Section 945.3, there was tolling from the date of the arrest to the date of sentencing. And that tolling was readily acknowledged both by the district court.
So that's not in dispute. What's disputed is the effect of CCP Section 356 during the pendency of the appeal of his conviction. That time period is the period that both sides are focusing on.
That's correct. That's certainly the aspect that we're focusing on. That's what I consider to be the second tolling period. And that's from the period of the date of the conviction to the date it was reversed. And
as to that period of time, what is the legal impediment to him filing the lawsuit and asking that it be stayed?
The Heck bar itself is the impediment. In fact, the Heck decision specifies that if a case is filed during the Heck bar period, the case must be dismissed.
But that's not really accurate, is it? I mean, the Heck bar says it must be dismissed if it is going to impugn the conviction. But they drop a footnote in Heck, and I think they later explain it in Wallace, that that's a question you can't determine until after the fact. You could have five facts that support the conviction, and he's only impugning one of them, and it may not actually impugn the conviction.
Yeah, and in certain circumstances, that may very well be true. In this case, the conviction was reversed for precisely the Fourth Amendment violations that Mr. Mills...
But couldn't he have asked the district court to stay the 1983 action pending the resolution of his state court appeal?
He certainly could have asked. I don't believe that Heck supports staying.
But Wallace supports staying.
Wallace supports the proposition that because the claim accrued on the date of the arrest, the claim could be filed at that point. And during that period of time between the date of the arrest and the date of conviction, when the Heck bar is not in effect, during that period of time, the district court may choose, just for logistical and practical reasons, to stay the case pending the outcome of the criminal prosecution, with the idea that there's no point in proceeding with the civil matter if ultimately it may be barred by Heck upon a conviction anyway. So the civil matter could be stayed. Once the conviction, however, is entered, we contend Heck would require dismissal. The idea of continuing to stay the matter during the Heck bar period.
You mean once the conviction happens on appeal, or once the conviction? You're saying once the conviction happened in the Superior Court, then Heck would require dismissal.
Under Heck, dismissal would be mandated.
I don't think that that's correct. Wallace seems to suggest just the opposite.
Wallace definitely suggests the opposite during that first period, from the date of accrual to the date of conviction. But it doesn't address, it doesn't indicate.
You're right as a technical matter, but I don't understand why just because they didn't distinguish in Wallace between during the Superior Court or during the appeal, I don't understand why there'd be a difference. I mean, ultimately, the question is, we have a problem here. There's no question there's a legal limbo here, right? I mean, we don't know whether he has no 1983 claim until his conviction is expunged in some way. And you don't know whether that's going to happen. If he's convicted in Superior Court, we don't know whether his claim, whether he's going to have a claim until the Court of Appeals acts. And the question is, is the statute told during that period? And Wallace seems to say no. And then the question is, does 356 come in? But under the plain terms of 356, I don't see how your client is prohibited. I don't see a statutory prohibition here. If anything, it's a judicially created prohibition under the California Supreme Court. But even that has said you have to show that it's legally not possible. I apologize, I don't have the phrase exactly right, but you have to show that it's legally not possible for him to bring the claim, and I don't think that's right.
It was legally not possible in the sense that had he filed it, the defendants would have been entitled to dismissal under Heck, the same as in other cases where the California courts have applied 356 in circumstances that required exhaustion of administrative remedies. In those cases, a plaintiff could certainly prematurely file their lawsuit.
Well,
in
but exhaustion
court.
Of administrative remedies is not a precondition for a 1983 action.
No, certainly not. And that's not what I'm arguing. But what I'm arguing is that in those circumstances, in the exhaustion context, the plaintiff certainly could prematurely file their claim. They could certainly prematurely file their lawsuit, but the defendant would be entitled to dismissal based on failure to exhaust. That's precisely the situation that would...
I understand the analogy. For one thing, mm-hmm. this is... there's no exhaustion necessary. This isn't a Rose v. Lundy situation. It's not a habeas. And for another, I don't really see why dismissal would be necessary. Usually what a court will do when the defendant in a criminal case files a civil action that affects the criminal case is he'll stay it because the prosecutor says it would be unfair to give him civil discovery. And that's actually the usual thing because the thing can't have its discovery. The plaintiff would be entitled to discovery. That's about it. I don't understand why you're talking about exhaustion.
Well, I bring it up only because I wanted to illustrate the point that Mr. Mills certainly could have asserted his 1983 claim post-conviction while the Heck bar was in effect. He could have asserted that claim. And it's possible that the district court would have responded to that
just
by staying
post-conviction?
Correct, just post-conviction. The pre-conviction tolling is not in dispute
post-conviction,
in this case.
Until he gets it set aside, he's just got nowhere to go because of Heck versus Humphrey.
That is precisely the issue. That's correct. And that is why 356 provides tolling during that period.
Assuming that he's not required to file in order to protect the statute and seek a stay.
Even under that circumstance, it's conceivable that he couldn't maintain the action. The statute of limitation would certainly expire. That's somewhat similar to what happened in Wallace, and the court says we're not going to recognize any federal equitable tolling, so we're going to look to state law for tolling. If state law does not provide that tolling, and in
the
Wallace
case, the question
case,
really
not,
is how broadly right. to read that particular state statute, mm-hmm. And if we read it as there's nothing legally preventing him from initiating the 1983 lawsuit, then he loses. But if you say, well, the Heck v. Humphrey bar would have kicked in and it would have caused the lawsuit to be dismissed, then he should be entitled to tolling for that. And that's your argument, I take it.
Yes, that is the argument, yes.
But I think, and I think that's where I struggle with it, because he has to be legally prevented from filing the claim. And you're asking us to make a determination that he was legally prevented because his action would have impugned his conviction before we even know whether his conviction, what the basis was for upholding the conviction. It's almost, you're asking us to make a determination of a question that's unanswerable until after the appeal comes out.
Under some circumstances, that may be true. In this case, it's actually precisely the opposite. The California Court of Appeal reversed Mr. Mills' criminal conviction based precisely on the Fourth Amendment violations that are the source of his 1983
claim. I understand that. But until that happened, we wouldn't have known why they might reverse it or whether there's other evidence. I mean, admittedly, there's other evidence here that could have been used. Now, the Court of Appeals didn't look at that. They took a pretty extreme remedy here and said you can't even retry him. But there's more. I mean, the real question was whether the drugs could be admitted or not. By the way, why weren't the drugs presented at trial? You're probably the wrong person to ask, but why weren't the drugs presented at trial? That's baffled me in this case.
I apologize. I'm the wrong person to ask.
But that was the only question. I mean, we don't know whether there was other evidence here that could have been affirmed on. So you're asking us to go into a record and make a determination. And by the way, determine that 356 applies to some cases based on the facts and some cases not because of the facts. And that just strikes me as a highly unusual way to apply 356.
Well, and in a different case, I agree with you. You may be asked to make that determination prospectively. In this case, just procedurally, we do have the benefit of hindsight in this case.
Let me ask you about one of the – oh, I'm sorry. Are you not done answering that question?
No, please.
On the benefit of hindsight, I wonder if now that we do have the benefit of hindsight, it means that the setting aside of the conviction really won't work for you to make the claim viable again because the jury did not accept the contention that the drugs were planted and that this fellow didn't have the drugs, and the Court of Appeals did not undermine that determination. Instead, what they did was determine that the evidence was wrongfully obtained, and once it was suppressed, that there was nothing left to prosecute this fellow with, so they directed the court below to dismiss. Why doesn't that close the issue on the collateral estoppel?
On the issue of collateral estoppel, we believe that it's not appropriate in this case because Mr. Mills did not have the opportunity to fully and fairly litigate the issue of evidence fabrication.
That's the right question, but why isn't the answer to it that he did?
Because the state trial court had incorrectly determined that the evidence, and if we assume that the evidence existed, that the evidence was obtained lawfully. And by incorrectly making that determination, it deprived Mr. Mills of his opportunity to fully and fairly argue fabrication.
I don't see
because
it. Let me tell you why I don't see it so you can help me on this, because it means I'm missing a part of your argument. The reason I don't see that is it seems to me that Mills had his chance to attack the evidence. It did come in. The unlawfully seized evidence did come in, and he had his chance to persuade the jury that it was planted. So he did have a full opportunity.
The reason that the determination regarding the lawfulness of the search and seizure is so critical in this case is because this was literally a case of credibility. This case came down to the police officer's testimony versus Mr. Mills' testimony. So the trier of fact, knowing that the police officer obtained this evidence only through illegal means,
that doesn't make the evidence false evidence.
Not necessarily, but it potentially impacts the police officer's credibility and is an important factor that the trier of fact should have the benefit of considering when determining that particular issue.
I don't know. If a police does an improper search, looks through the drawers when he's only allowed to look at things in plain view or something like that, and finds the drugs, it doesn't mean the drugs weren't there. It just means the search was bad.
And certainly the jury or trier of fact, if it was the court, if it was a trier of fact, could reject Mr. Mills' argument, but he should be able to present the fact that the unlawfulness of the search, the unlawfulness of the seizure, impacts the police officer's credibility.
Let me ask a different question about the police officer credibility that's been bothering me a lot. Do you mind if I
go ahead.
If you believe the pleadings and the findings and the remarks of the court below about all the misconduct by the police in this particular locality, looks like they stole thousands of dollars from this fellow. And I would think, if I were on a jury, once I learned that the cops had stolen thousands of dollars of the defendant's money, police credibility would just be gone. Did that come out at the trial?
Your Honor, to be frank, I don't know if that particular issue came out at trial.
Guy ever
but that
get his
highlights
money back?
A portion of it, not
it
the full.
It looked like it was $1,050 that he didn't get back. Why didn't he sue on that?
Correct.
That seems a pretty viable claim.
I believe that he had some issues regarding timeliness of his state tort claims.
So they got to keep the money because he was late suing to get the money back that they stole?
A small fraction of it, apparently.
It looked like first the cop reported on his police report less money than he actually took. And then they lied again about how much money they took and he never got all the money back. Is that right?
That's correct. That's my understanding. That's a correct statement of the facts, but it's certainly not right.
And did all that come out at the trial?
My understanding is that most of that came out at trial, which is all the more reason why the unlawfulness
did come out at the trial, and they still believe the cop about the dope really being from his car instead of the cop's pocket.
And that's why Mr. Mills needed every bit of factual information to give to the jury regarding the officer's credibility. So the lawfulness of his search and the trier of fact knowing that the search was unlawful was absolutely critical, and he was denied that opportunity.
Thank you.
Our questioning took you over I'll make it up to you by putting 2 minutes on the clock when you come back.
Oh, I greatly appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Tony Sain on behalf of appellees and defendants, City of Covina and Officer Terrence Hanu. With me is also appearing counsel, Ms. Tricia Newman. I will be addressing the statute of limitations argument for appellees, and Ms. Newman will be addressing the collateral estoppel.
Incidentally, do you disagree with anything your friend just said about the police stealing the money and it coming out at trial?
Your Honor, I don't believe that was a determination that was made by the jury. I do believe that the allegation that
some
of the money was not
out at trial?
I believe the allegation that the money was not returned came out at trial, but I don't think it was part of the case. I don't think it was necessarily litigated in the same way, nor is it.
The jury heard about the police report showing a lower amount of money than they actually took from the arrestee?
I seem to recall testimony on that from Mr. Mills at trial, yes. But in terms of the statute of limitations argument, Your Honor, I want to address one thing that was raised by appellant's counsel just a moment ago. Appellant's counsel argued that Section 356 establishes some sort of bar because there's a case law prohibition to filing, and that's not what Section 356 says at all. In their reply brief, appellants cite to the case, a Supreme Court case in California called Hoover, for the proposition that if there's a legal impediment to the claim, that Section 356 tolling may be implicated. And that's not correct. In Hoover itself, the page that says that a legal impediment may implicate Section 356 tolling, that page is 526. But the very next page, 527, the Supreme Court notes that Plaintiff Hoover was barred by statute from proceeding with his judgment enforcement action. In other words, in Hoover, it was the corporation's code that operated to bar Plaintiff Hoover from filing that action, and therefore, in Hoover, Section 356 applied. And there is a post-Hoover case that the court can reference. It's called Berkeley Unified School District versus State of California, 33 Cal App 4th at 350, a 1995 case, that illustrates this point very succinctly. In that particular case, the district plaintiffs had filed an untimely claim, but they were asserting that Section 356 operated as a toll on the statute of limitations. And in their argument, they said, well, we couldn't file earlier because there wasn't an administrative final decision, and so since we would be assumed to have failed to exhaust our administrative remedies, we should get Section 356 tolling. And the California Court of Appeal expressly rejected that idea and noted that having a sort of a disability, some flaw, some inability to maintain your claim doesn't mean that you are unable to file your claim. So Section 356, it cannot be construed the way that appellants have argued. However,
So I think you get the better of that argument, but here's the question is when 356, under that theory, are we inviting a whole bunch of claims in the district court? I mean, there is some, something good about requiring the conviction to be expunged because you figure, you know, only 10% of the time or whatever the number is it going to be overturned on appeal? So why should we inundate the federal district courts with these cases before we know whether they even have a claim?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, Your Honor's point is raised in the Wallace case itself, where the Supreme Court, the same judge that wrote the Wallace opinion, Justice Scalia, also wrote the Heck opinion and expressed that very concern that if we were to adopt this argument that the Heck bar also operated as a tolling of the statute of limitations, there would in effect be no such thing as statutes of limitations because all criminal cases would be effectively untold while the criminal case was proceeding. And that is not how the case law works. The Wallace court expressly rejected the idea.
There's a binary choice, right? You wait until the conviction is final with a determination on appeal, and then you know whether you're subject to the Heck bar or not, and you file the case then. Or if you interpret 356 the way that you do, you have to protectively file and seek a stay in the district court, which is a discretionary call by the district court, right?
A stay would be discretionary, yes, Your Honor. However, no less an authority than the...
Does it make more sense to just go ahead and wait until the conviction is final before filing?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the Supreme Court tells us that it doesn't make more sense. In Wallace itself, when presented with that distinction, the Supreme Court told us that what plaintiffs should do is file before their cause of action is time barred. So the...
What was the time period that was discussed in Wallace, though, while the case was pending in the trial court, or was it also an appellate situation?
I believe, Your Honor, that the time barred issue in Wallace was while they convict or while it was still pending in the trial court, if I remember correctly.
Right. However, and that makes sense, right? There's a distinction between the time period when you're in the trial court versus the time period during the pendency of appeal.
No, Your Honor, and I would actually agree with Judge Nelson on that particular issue, that the whether or not there's a conviction pending or a conviction has already been rendered, whether or not the time bar applies turns on whether or not Heck itself prevents you from filing the action, not whether you can maintain the action. And if we look back to Section 356 again, Section 356 does not create a case law impediment to filing an action. And the only exception for tolling under Section 356 is whether there's an injunction in force or whether there's some sort of statutory prohibition to filing, neither of which applied here.
I just want to be clear, and I guess this is what you were arguing at the beginning, because I agree with you. I mean, the statute 356 only says injunction or a statute. I had interpreted the California Supreme Court to have extended that into judicial remedies. But maybe you're arguing now that's not true, that Hoover actually was a statutory prohibition.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. In fact, at page 527, you can see that it based that particular tolling of Section 356 on the Corporations Code, a statutory prohibition.
But regardless, we are bound by the California Supreme Court's interpretation of 356. We can't go back and say they went too far. We're not going to enforce that in federal court. We're bound by whatever the California Supreme Court has said 356 means. Is that right?
To the extent that the Supreme Court has mandated that state tolling provisions are to be followed, yes, Your Honor, that's true.
Yeah, you've got a good textual argument, so I agree with Judge Nelson there in terms of the statute itself referring to the injunction or a statutory bar. But I also read Hoover to have expanded that concept beyond the textual analysis of 356, because Hoover did talk about cases where it's not possible to bring a lawsuit because the case was pending appeal. How do you grapple? How would you have us grapple with that language in Hoover? I recognize that ultimately there was a reference to statutory bar, but they did go back and look at the history of other cases as well, and other cases rely on the common bar where when appeal is pending, you don't file the lawsuit.
I think that in order to reconcile those two, we need only look at the Berkeley case, Your Honor. The Berkeley case is a California Court of Appeal case that interpreted Hoover and distinguished Hoover and really helps define what Hoover stood for. And it noted in that case
that... Give me the cite to Berkeley again.
Yes,
do you
Your
have
Honor.
It handy?
Yes, I do. It's 33 California App 4th, 350, a 1995 case, and the pertinent pages, Your Honors, are 364 through 365. And in that case, much like appellants here, they argued that under Hoover, there was tolling under Section 356 because there was a legal impediment to their claim, namely the failure to exhaust administrative remedies. And the Berkeley court made it very clear that a legal impediment to your claim like that is not an impediment to filing your claim. And it distinguished the Hoover facts from the Berkeley facts. In Hoover, the corporation's code barred plaintiff Hoover from even filing his lawsuit until he had an enforceable final judgment. And only then, under the corporation's code, was plaintiff Hoover allowed to file a lawsuit.
Hoover and that's written more broadly than what you say. Hoover says, apparently with approval, that the section has been applied in situations where the action is legally prohibited by other means than injunctions or statutory prohibitions. That means it doesn't take a statute. They seem to say that with approval.
I think that is correct in terms of the language that they use, Your Honor, but even in Hoover, they're applying it to a statutory bar, and post-Hoover cases have made it clear, I believe.
Thing, it's dicta.
Yes, Your Honor.
But even if that were binding, I think where I still get hung up is that you have to be legally prohibited, and I just don't see how the plaintiff here was legally prohibited from filing.
Yes, Your Honor, we agree. In fact, the court in Wallace made it very clear that the heck bar does not operate to prevent you from filing. It may operate to prevent you from being able to maintain your claim post-filing, but it's not a bar to filing. And absent a bar to filing, Section 356 does not apply for
well,
tolling.
Well, and Justice Scalia made, I thought, a pretty compelling argument in Wallace as well, which is at the end of the day, the statute of limitations is needed so that the city's are on notice that they have to preserve evidence. It would be pretty counterintuitive to say, I mean, some of these cases could come up 10 years later, that it's expunged in some way, and then at that point they're going to bring a 1983 action and nobody's thought about this for the last 10 years and you know, all the evidence is gone. We don't know what happened to the extra $1,000 that has mysteriously disappeared. So, I mean, that seems to be a policy reason that supports requiring a precautionary filing in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. For those reasons, we believe that all the claims but the malicious prosecution claim are time-barred under Section 356 in the operable California codes. And in light of that, Your Honor, I will...
Save Ms. Newman some time.
Yes, Your Honor. That was exactly what I was about to do, is invite her up to address the court's issues on collateral estoppel. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. Just before I start talking about collateral estoppel, to address some of the questions that were already presented, the reason generally drugs aren't entered into the LA Superior Court is because they don't want the jurors to have access to them. So generally it's they introduce the testing that shows what the drugs actually are. They
the
show
photos.
Pictures. They provide the chain of custody so that they can determine whether there is actually drugs.
So that was this was standard in this case. It wasn't unusual that the drugs weren't given to the jury.
Correct, Your Honor. And
it was testimony. We had the drugs and they've been tested. And here's the expert from the lab, and he
says
it's
correct. And that is standard because they don't want drugs going back with a jury.
Oh, we used to have bags of cocaine in district court when I was a district judge, but you don't do that there.
Well, for the years I was in the Superior Court, that was not the case. It was it's standard to just present testing and the experts to say, this is what we tested, here's our chain of custody, make a determination by the jury.
So it's an interesting point. I want to ask you, and I don't want to shortchange your argument, but I have a problem with collateral estoppel here. Where the conviction was reversed, it seems to me you can't rely, and nor do you need to rely on collateral estoppel. You seem to be advocating a position that you can sort of have mini collateral estoppel for issues that only the jury or the fact finder found, and I can't find case law that really supports that. So maybe you could point us to that if it exists.
I'm sorry. You lost me for a second there. The jury found in this specific case a very specific issue that he did possess drugs.
Well, we don't know that. Presumably they did.
Is it a general verdict or a special verdict? Or I don't remember reading any instructions in the excerpts of record.
Well, in the criminal case, the jury instructions is solely a finding of possession, whether he possessed or not. The specific factual...
The instructions in the excerpts?
I don't believe the excerpts.
Was it a general verdict or a special verdict?
General.
So we don't know what they found.
Your theory is the inference, right? Given that the defense is the police planted it on me by convicting, the jury rejected that.
Correct, because that was what was specifically argued by his criminal defense attorney throughout the case. It was in the closing. It was the only defense that was presented, was whether they believed Mr. Mills or whether they believed Officer Hanu. So it was a question of, and Mr. Mills did testify in his own defense in the case, and stated that these drugs were planted. They were not mine. I did not have them. I did not possess them. And so the jury specifically rejected that as the defense. That was the only defense that was presented.
But once that's reversed, I don't understand how collateral estoppel applies.
It was reversed based on a prolonged detention.
I understand that, but I don't see any case law that suggests that when a conviction is reversed, we're still going to say there's collateral estoppel for an issue that the jury may have decided, and maybe you're 90% right that that's what the jury decided.
In the briefing, the collateral estoppel arguments, there are several that state that what a jury has found, even in spite of reversal or dismissal, you elevate form over substance if you look specifically just to whether something is saying there's a dismissal, there's been a reversal. They still look at to what the jury found. And if we look at Hydronautics, it dealt with a case where the verdict was vacated. There was a jury verdict. It was vacated because a dismissal was negotiated for it. And the court still found that they weren't going to ignore a jury verdict just based on the words that were put into the negotiated dismissal after.
Was that a case where there were some findings as opposed to a general verdict?
Yes.
Well,
actually, Your Honor, I
have trouble knowing what the jury found in a general verdict. A case where I don't have the instructions.
Well, unfortunately, in most criminal cases, there aren't special verdicts.
Of course, of course. But you look at the instructions usually, and you say, the instructions say you can't convict unless you found such and such, and they did convict, so you know they found such and such.
Yes, and Your Honor, in this situation, when you only have one defense that was presented, the jury would have had
No, it doesn't matter what the lawyers say. The lawyers offer reasons why the jury should or should not believe this or that. But ultimately, the jury is never instructed to follow what the lawyers say. They're instructed to follow what the judge says in the jury instructions.
And in this instance, there was no defense that the drugs did not exist. The drugs existed. Everyone has acknowledged there were drugs. It was just a question of whether Mr. Mills possessed it or whether Mr. Hanu planted it, and the jury found that he possessed it. It was the only conclusion that could have been arrived at based on the evidence that had been presented. And
is there some reason that we don't have the jury instructions in a case where your collateral estoppel argument depends on them? I don't understand.
Well, That may have been my mistake in not including that in my motion, Your Honor.
But here's the question. Why do we need to decide this issue? In my opinion, why don't we just go in and say every time the jury finds a conviction, that establishes probable cause, and therefore you can't bring in a 1983 action, even if that conviction is later. At a minimum, there was probable cause to go after him if you got a jury conviction.
Which I think is the favorable termination argument,
yeah.
And which is separate and apart from the collateral estoppel
argument. I agree, and that's why I'm asking the question, because it seems to me like that's much safer ground to go on. I have a hard time with the collateral estoppel argument.
Yes, Your Honor, which is why we've asked the court to also affirm on the alternative grounds of favorable termination. I do think collateral estoppel, the elements applied in this case, as well as there's been plenty of...
It's a tougher ground, so you've got the alternative argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And I am over time, but...
Thank you. Unless my colleagues have any additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to thank the court for its indulgence, a couple of extra minutes. I think it's important to put a little bit finer of a point. I want to address with regard to the statute of limitations and the effect of the Heck bar and this the notion that the Heck bar prohibits maintaining an action, but you're certainly free to file it.
Maintaining an action if it's going to impugn the conviction. That's the problem. I mean, you mentioned the Heck bar as if it automatically exists, but it doesn't exist. That's the whole problem here. It doesn't exist until we find out that it isn't going to impugn the conviction.
That's correct, and in this case, we know that it did. In some, you are correct that in some other case, it may be possible to not know whether a 1983 claim impugns the conviction. In this case, we know that it did. This court, and this is the Cesar, this is cited in the briefs, decisions from this circuit that concluded that Fourth Amendment unlawful search claim was barred, finding that there was no probable cause for the search would necessarily imply the invalidity of plaintiff's conviction. I mean, the Heck bar is quite literally a bar. And so although we may be able to say that the Heck bar doesn't prohibit the filing of an action, it merely prohibits the maintaining of the action, I think that may be a distinction without a difference.
Can I just ask one question? Your time's running out. The fact that he was convicted in the jury, even if it's overturned, why isn't that enough to say there was probable cause here for the malicious prosecution claim?
Because the issue of fabrication was not fully and fairly litigated. The jury that convicted was not also given the additional information that the alleged evidence, had been obtained unlawfully. And in a case that turned on credibility, it was very important that the jury know that. Ultimately, the jury may not think much of that. That may not be a successful argument, but Mr. Mills had, in order to fully and fairly litigate that issue, should have been given an opportunity to provide it to the jury.
All right. Thank you
very much
to both sides for your very helpful arguments in this case. It's submitted for decision by the court.